When Dawn was 9, she would lie in her bed and think of infinity while crickets filled the night with tiny cries. First her mind would go to the moon, then Mars, then to the edge of the Milky Way. From there she would cross unimaginable emptiness, passing the Magellanic Clouds, the Andromeda Galaxy, and then galaxies so remote they were little more than theoretical possibilities. Soon the known universe was nothing but a trail of glowing dust shrinking behind her back, while the unknown expanded all around her, filling itself with ever more galaxies, clouds, black holes, and ever vaster emptinesses. So vast that the Milky Way, the planet Earth, New Jersey, her town, her split-level home, and even she herself, lying on her bed in a cotton nightie, diminished entities of such profound insignificance, they trembled on the edge of non-being. And in that instant, she would lapse into a peacefulness so complete she could not distinguish it from joy. The first time Dawn sees the bear-like young man with hair like a petrified dust cloud, he is standing outside the observatory with a glossy green-black glob resting on his hand. Feeling her gaze, he looks up and smiles. "A salamander," he says, and swings his hand around gently so that she might see. When Todd was 9, space was something like a jungle gym into which, aided by rocket ships and wormholes, he would climb from planet to planet, star to star, galaxy to galaxy, until he would reach the edge of the curved universe, where, by a miracle that only he might accomplish, he could slip through whatever it was that marked the boundary between existence and all else, and enter a realm where no law of nature made sense, and even mathematics had to be completely reimagined. "Doesn't that kill them?" Dawn asks the bear-like a young man. He is still mild, smiling, and she decides he is excessively stupid. "What?" he says. "There's something on our skin," she says. "It destroys their protective layer of mucus." "Oh," the smiles fades. "Really?" "Of course," she says. But all at once it occurs to her that she might be thinking about fish or moths. As the young man looks down at his hand, the salamander oozes over the tips of his pressed together fingers, hits the rust-red gravel path, and slapping the ground with its starburst feet, wriggle walks into the high grass, where it is soon only an intermittent hiss and a twitching of green blades. The young man smiles again, but then he looks worried. He says. His smile comes back, but it is the neurotic twin of his original smile. He thrusts the hand from which the salamander has just oozed in Dawn's direction. He says, "Todd Spagliaro." She sidles around the hand in the direction of the observatory door. "Pleased to meet you." Dawn is 43 and Todd is 38. It's the stuffed sausage wonder of his neck and cheeks that makes him look 2 decades younger than his true age. Also, he has more than the usual allotment of human facial expressions. In between those connected to things he is actually saying or doing, his eyebrows wriggle or tilt, and his mouth forms sneers, astonished O's, or dreamy smiles, all of which make it seem as if he is having spirited interactions in 2 or more dimensions simultaneously. Dawn, on the other hand, suffers from an expression deficit, and the majority of the expressions she does make are most commonly seen on gargoyles. She's 6 feet tall, sapling skinny, and habitually walks around with her forearms raised and her hands dangling. She has frequently been compared to a praying mantis. 7 months previously, Dawn and Todd each received an email from the Wendell Institute for Interstellar Investigation, offering them a 3-month summer fellowship at the Institute's state-of-the-art observatory and astrobiological think tank, in Wendell, Montana. This year's fellows, prominent scholars in the fields of radio and infrared telemetry, exoplanet habitability, hypothetical neurology, interstellar communication, and the sociology of advanced civilizations, end quote, would be investigating the problem of the quiet universe. Cornell did not expand upon the precise nature of the problem, nor was the linked page at WIII.org any more illuminating. But the photographs on other pages of the website showed mule deer grazing in a field of radio telescopes, a silver observatory gleaming atop a crag of red volcanic rock, and a gaggle of stubble-cheeked men in enormous cowboy hats playing guitars in front of a wall of bison, bear, and pronghorn trophy heads. In addition to free access to research facilities, fellows were provided with room and board, expeditions to natural and historic attractions, and a stipend of $50,000. Dawn was a professor of astronomy at Texas Tech, but had just been denied tenure. Todd's thesis on the physics of orphan planet formation was 10 years overdue, and he worked as a sales clerk at Amoeba Records in Berkeley, California. Neither he nor Dawn hesitated more than half a minute before accepting the invitation. When Dawn arrived at the airport, a white van with WIII inscribed in 2-foot-high evergreen letters on both flanks was waiting for her. The driver looked 15, but was wearing a white blouse with a gold brooch at the collar, a slim-fitting gray skirt, sheer stockings, and 4-inch heels. She worked in the hospitality industry, she told Dawn, and only drove for the Institute to save money for college. She wanted to major in hospitality. That's the only kind of work there is around here, she said. The receptionist in WIII's administrative office was tall and athletic, with Windex blue hair. She was wearing cargo pants and a t-shirt with a hole just above and to the right of her belly button, apparently a cigarette accident. She touched Dawn on the shoulders and upper arms, as if they were old friends. She smiled as if they shared a salacious secret. Her name was Jen. "We are so honored to have you here, Dr. Finkeis," Jen said as they walked across the grounds towards the fellow's residence. "Dan can't wait to meet you." That smile came back and she stroked Dawn's upper arm. Dan was Dan Wendell, the founder and benefactor, not just of WIII, but of the town of Wendell. He was an oil and uranium tycoon and had more money than half the countries of the world combined. His interest in the earth naturally led to his interest in the sky, she explained. 214 people lived in Wendell, and 202 of them were Dan's top executives, their families, his wife, 6 children, and himself. Dawn's room looked like a room in a motel that aspired to be a room in a bed and breakfast. Doilies, glass knob dresser, shaker-style headboard, marble top sink, and an alcove composed entirely of mirrors. "Make yourself at home," said Jen. "Dinner is at 7 o'clock." When she left, the room turned dim and lonely. Atop Dawn's dresser was a photocopied list of the current WIII fellows. 3 of them among the outside experts her department had approached when she went up for tenure. All 3 probably knew that she had been turned down. They might even have written the very letters that had sabotaged her case. She lay on her bed and covered her face with her hands. After a while, the vault-like silence inside her room made it impossible to breathe. She went for a walk. The dining hall looks like the restaurant at Mount Rushmore, or at least how that restaurant looked in North by Northwest. Dawn has never been to Mount Rushmore, and she doesn't remember the movie though, but she does remember that the restaurant had 2-story-high windows facing the stone presidents. This dining hall has 2-story-high windows facing miles of ultra-green grass, a black sprinkling of Angus cattle, and a range of hills shaped like shark fins, each with 2 or 3 rust-red boulders on its flanks. There was room for 100 people at the hall's redwood tables, but only 1 seat in the whole room is occupied by the bear-like man with the dust-colored hair, whom she encountered on her walk. His back is to her. He is facing the view. Dawn contemplates taking a seat at another table, but then realizes that if she sits opposite the strange young man, then there'll be less chance of her winding up face-to-face with one of the outside experts. "Hi," she says, sliding her plate between silverware across from Todd. There are things about sex that Tom just doesn't understand. Do women actually like to cover their bodies with strapped together pieces of black leather and have their wrists chained to bedposts? Do they really find their own breasts so sexy that they can't help fondling them every time they wake up? There is a way that perfectly ordinary men make the transition from standing beside a woman at a bus stop to lying naked with her under the covers of a bed. What is it? Of course, he has seen countless movies and read countless books in which a series of deft insults traded with wry smiles leads directly to a full body clinch under the pouring rain. But how is it possible to come up with so many deft insults in a row, or even just one? And why is it that insults open the door to physical union and not frank declarations of love? Todd can actually imagine a proclaiming love to a woman, or looking into her eyes and asking if she would be interested in kissing him. Many, many times, he has sat beside a woman in a classroom or stood next to one at a record rack and wanted to cover her small, smooth hand with his big, hairy one. But why is it that every single time such a thought enters his mind, his ears go hot, the room begins to whirl, and a queasiness twists up from his stomach into his sinuses? Why is it impossible for him to speak the word hello in the presence of a beautiful woman? Why do the very desires that propel the entire human race into one another's arms cause him to writhe in a silent, sweaty mass of shame? Where is everybody? Says Tom. Excuse me, says Tom. They have eaten in silence for at least 6.5 minutes. The sun has gone from beer gold to brick dust orange. Thin-shaped shadows are rising along the slopes of the shark fin hills. There's nobody here, says Don. Todd looks over his shoulder, turns back and shrugs. Jed says some of the people will be delayed. He impales the last elbow of mac and cheese on his fork and puts it into his mouth. Looks like everybody's delayed, says Don. I don't see how that's possible. There must be 60 people on that list, and they left in our rooms, and they're all supposed to be here today. 57. What? Dawn's brow furrows vertically. She pushes her face forward and squints. Her hair is black and stringy, but she looks a bit like Joni Mitchell, same cheekbones, that wide mouth, and broad upper lip. As Todd begins to construct an image of the body underneath her fleece vest and t-shirt, he has to look away. 57, he says, on the list. Up. When Todd looks back, one side of Dawn's mouth is smiling, and her opposite eyebrow has formed a skeptical check mark. She shakes her head and leans back in her chair. Anyhow, she says, it seems totally bizarre to me that 55 out of 57 people should fail to show up on the day a conference starts. I've never heard of a thing like that. Maybe it's like the end of the world, he says. Again, her brow furrows, her face juts forward, she squints, but this time doesn't say anything. You know, he says, that Bradbury story about the village that's so remote it never gets the news that the world has ended, and so people just go on with their normal lives. She lets out a flat ha, smiles and shakes her head. Tom's face goes watermelon red, and his ears start to burn. He wonders if she thinks he has made a joke.